Extra time.
Hello there, Football Daily, and welcome back to the Extra Time podcast, this week hosted by me, Henry Hill. And we've got a bit of a Continental Club special going on, from what I can see. I'm joined this week by Doogie Critchley and Mikey McCubbin. Mikey, I'll come to you first. How are you doing, my friend? Have you recovered from Hampton and Richmond's crushing defeat at the hands of Dorking Wanderers?
Oh, just about. Yeah, for anyone who doesn't know, me and Henry went to see both our local clubs play each other on the weekend. And yeah, it was a pretty comprehensive win for Dorking Wanderers, who sit pretty top at the top of the National League South. I was looking afterwards, because I haven't actually gone and seen Hampton in quite a while. So I was a little bit disappointed, but it did seem like quite a threadbare team. I don't know whether COVID had anything to do with that. But I looked afterwards, and actually most of the noises coming out of the Hampton camp were that they were pretty happy with the performance, and they were just coming up against a much more accomplished side, which is, you know, goes to show at the top of the table. So yeah, Dorking Wanderers,
absolutely
team to watch.
In particular, the mighty Cox,
who's the right winger who plays for
Briggsy. Briggsy.
Briggsy, that's it. Yeah, I mean, he's
of course he's called Briggsy.
He's an absolute animal. Oh, yeah, this is another thing. Dorking Wanderers, the first ever team I've seen at that level who have names on the back of their shirts. I think it's a bit of a travesty personally, but maybe I'm just a bit of a grumpy old man. Maybe this is just where it's going, you know, the modernisation of the non-league.
Listen,
but I was pretty amazed by that.
When you're a big circus show, you know, pleasing the south of England all over, they need to know who's performing well. And I have to say, McCubbin, your pitch side etiquette is shocking. The amount of filthy tackles that went in by Hampton players, and you were screaming at the Dorking players to get up and shut up.
I don't think I told any of them to shut up. I did tell them to get up a couple of times. My worst side does come out in non-league, unfortunately.
Love that.
If you think Cubbin's a passive guy, a chilled out bloke on the channel, just go watch a non-league game of him, and you'll see a whole different animal. Doogie, do you lose your mind a bit when you watch sport, or do you manage to contain it?
No, I do get quite angry, actually. I do. Not proud of it, actually. Yeah, particularly playoffs with Sunderland over the last few years, I've been in a real rage. I had to watch the second leg of the semi-final last year at a friend's barbecue, and everyone was like, what is that noise coming from inside? And it was just me absolutely losing it as we threw away yet another opportunity to go back to the championship. So yeah, I can get pretty angry as well.
You're quite brave, Doogie, for putting yourself through that, like going to a social event where people are within earshot of you, like for such a big game. Like, I think I'd just have to stay at home.
I think we were 2-0 down at the time, so it was kind of tie over. But then we brought it back to 2-2, I think, at half time of that game, and I was like, yes, we're going back up. And then of course we weren't. Quickly we just crumbled. But yeah, I can socialise after football quite quickly. I'm quite good at switching off. I don't get into a long-term slump.
What is the clips of you on the old live streams of you getting overexcited or grabbing people's arms that I've been told
Yeah,
about?
Definitely. I used to love... Yeah, we used to do them quite regularly. Hopefully we'll be able to do that when the studio reopens, which we're hoping to happen next month. But yeah, we used to do regular streams called Total Football, where we watched the Champions League and people used to watch it along with us. And I just love the Champions League. I get very, very invested in it. I think it's because I go in as a complete neutral. And there was just a couple of years, like 2018-19 and 2019-20, I think, were just phenomenal years in the Champions League. There was so much drama. I absolutely loved it.
Yeah, agree.
I remember the Ajax streams and the City Tottenham streams were like, they're stuff of legend, aren't they?
Oh, you know what? Most people don't realise at home is I joined the company, and within about 1 month, we all started working from home. So over my 2.5 year stay at Football Daily, I think 85% of it has been sat in my bedroom. So I look forward to getting back in the live streams with all of you boys. But anyway, let's crack on with the main portion of the podcast, because as it's about halfway through the season across most of Europe, we wanted to take a look at some of the sort of maybe less talked about leagues across the continent and look at some of the weird stories and trends that we've seen this year, because it is quite a surprising year for football. I think a lot of that has to do with COVID, the way that the fixtures are structured this year, and finances all over the shop. We're seeing a lot of teams that perhaps not normally doing well, shooting up in big positions at the moment. A lot of the big sides are really struggling across the continent. We wanted to touch on that at the moment. Let's just kick off with the Premier League, though, because, Dukes, the big news this week I guess once again, we did an Everton podcast recently, but it is Everton and kind of their sacking of Rafa Benitez after the sacking of Brands as director and the selling of Dean at their fullback. I mean, it looks like Mashiri's really, dare I say it, losing his marbles in this one. I mean, what is this probably the most ridiculous thing we've seen in the league this season?
Yeah, I think it's just a sign of how clueless and directionless Everton have been under Mashiri. I think is that eight managers they've had since 2016 now? Absolutely crazy. Some of the names in there that I just completely forgot about, you know, Ronald Koeman, Sam Allardyce, Marco Silva. I mean, I will temper this with the fact that I do think there's an element of bad luck that they've had this season. Obviously, they didn't plan for Carlo Ancelotti to walk away for the Real Madrid job. In the end, they got in Rafa Benitez, probably quite a shrewd appointment at the time. But then James Rodriguez fell out with him or didn't want to play under him, left the club. That was their main source of creativity last year. Calvert-Lewin's had his injury issues. Richarlison's had his injury issues. They lost another source of creativity in Gylfi Sigurdsson, who is, of course, facing a trial coming up as well, which must have affected the squad in some respect as well. We can't go into detail about that, obviously. But then they've had their injury issues at the back as well. And it just has been a catalogue of misfiring performances and misfiring stars as well. I think some of their players just really need to take a hard look at themselves this year. I think Andre Gomez has been really poor. I'd expect better from Milan, coming from such a big reputation, from Napoli as well, started so well last year. And Everton's stats and on-pitch performances, so failing the eye test as well, they've just been dreadful. I think possession, they're really low. Pass accuracy, they're really low. Any entertainment factor, just non-existent really. And I think Benitez eventually had what was coming to him. I think they won, was it 6 points out of a possible 36? It might have been even less in the final 12 games of his tenure. So, yeah, I can't say I was exactly the surprise, but it's just a slightly surprising element in that what they'd done the previous month with Marcel Brands, the team doctor, Luca Digne, the scouting network being changed as well. And then they panicked so much after Norwich and decided to sack the man that was seemingly behind all of that. So it was a little bit confusing, yeah.
Honestly, I was one of the people that backed Benitez. I thought this was going to be a match made in heaven. So I've got it completely wrong. I mean, what a polarising manager. Either goes incredibly well or awfully wherever he seems to go at the moment. And it was interesting, I saw sort of a quote from Bill Kenwright saying how once upon a time he was told a director would say, what would Everton do in the situation when they were weighing up how to approach a scenario? And I mean, that's a laughable statement now. I mean, McCubbin, what do you think is like a success for Everton this season in terms of going forward from here?
Well, what could be a success? I think putting together some sort of a long-term plan. They're kind of back to zero now, it feels like. You know, Marcel Brands, when he was brought in 2018, I think it was. And, you know, Marco Silva was really the kind of project that he was invested in terms of buying players for what he was doing. And ever since then, ever since Silva left, it's kind of felt like they've been feeling their way a bit. I think they were very fortunate to get, you know, a manager like Ancelotti in. And even, you know, Ancelotti's vision in terms of his signings and whatnot were not really in keeping with what Brands was about. So already there were cracks beginning to show there. And we did a video on them last year, actually, which wasn't the best times because they were actually in quite a good vein of form, but would be... very topical now in that they've, you know, spent so much money over the last 5-6 years. You know, I think they've got, you know, their top five net spend in Europe, I'm pretty sure. And they've got worse, like they have got worse. So I think, yeah, like there's reasons to be positive from an Everton standpoint in that, you know, they've got this amazing new stadium that's going to be opening in the next 2-3 years. You know, the club has like modernized itself under Mashiri, and he is a very generous owner. You know, there's nothing to say that, as long as they can keep within financial fair play regulations, that he won't keep on pumping money into the club on transfers, etc. But like, yeah, it's clear that the last 5 years they haven't really gone anywhere in terms of a footballing project. They have to kind of start from square one again, I think. I think they have to wipe the slate completely clean. I think they kind of have, haven't they, in terms of the amount of personnel that they've lost from the club in the last 2 months. They just have to get the next appointment right, or at least make a more progressive appointment, I think.
No, absolutely. I have a personal vendetta against Mashiri. I'm not sure about him. I was meant to go on a holiday with a girl that I'd been seeing for a long time, and then she got invited by Mashiri to go on a boat of his in the south of France, and she chose to go on that holiday, and we never saw each other again. So
she got stolen away from you
by Mashiri. So that is a true story.
You've got links with like loads of owners in football, yeah. Weren't you? Something like Beppe Morata's daughter as well. You were seeing for a bit or something.
What? Who? No.
You were supposed to go to an Italian wedding, and I thought there was Morata's daughter.
No. The daughter of the former Inter chairman. I can't remember his name. The guy with big glasses. But I did used to work for one of the Siwiris brothers, one of the Egyptian guys at Aston Villa. But no.
You used to work for one of them.
Yeah, I used to work for one of the Siwiris brothers out in Egypt. Which I'll talk about that another time. This isn't about me. But
I think this could be a whole podcast series in itself, Henry. Yeah, I've never met anyone with so many links to football's elite.
Before COVID, my life was something. But here we are. But what am I saying? Anyway. I completely agree. Everton do need to wipe the slate clean. And quickly, the cupboard. Because obviously when we get together, we talk about European football mainly. But if you look at United's position in the table, as the United fan, we never really get to hear your opinion on this too much. I mean, how do you see sort of the rest of the season shaping up for United? Because that must be one of the stranger stories of the year. The fact that they brought Ronaldo in, that hasn't really kicked on for them either. I mean, where do you think they go in the next few months under Rangnick?
It's a difficult one. I think it's, you know, especially the last month has shown just how difficult a situation, you know, Rangnick inherited at United, and how, you know, after, you know, a good 3 years of what seemed to be a better squad harmony under Solskjaer, that things aren't quite where perhaps we hoped they would have been. You know, I think lots of people prematurely put United as title challengers at the start of the season. I don't think that was ever really a realistic ambition for this side, if I'm honest, where they really stood. But like Champions League football should have been a given, and obviously that's not. And I feel like United are very much outsiders in the Champions League race now. So it's going to be. I think it's going to be a slog the next 3 months. To be honest, I think it reminds me a bit of the season when Jose Mourinho was sacked and then Solskjaer came in halfway through the season. It kind of felt like in January that the season was already a write-off. And so, you know, barring a miracle in the Champions League against Atletico Madrid, I don't think there's a huge amount to get excited about for United fans over the next 3 months. I think that there just has to be better planning for whoever succeeds Rangnick. I think there needs to be, you know, one or two players who are perhaps, you know, done deals before the end of the season is even upon us. I think, you know, John Murto and Darren Fletcher have like a really big job on their hands now. They've really got to show, you know, they've really got to kind of show their credentials, you know, and obviously Richard Arnold taking over as CEO as well. I imagine he will be pretty keen to kind of have a good positive first summer. But yeah, there's a lot more holes in that squad. I think the main thing is that I think there's more holes in that team than there seemed to be at the start of the season. At the start of the season, we were only talking about, you know, a defensive midfielder, and now suddenly, you know, the attack looks a bit lopsided, even though Jadon Sancho, you know, was seemingly the answer to those problems. The defence, you know, looks worse than it has done in about 3 or 4 years. There's a lot of questions going into the final stage of the season. But I think the club already need to be thinking about next season in a big, big way.
Well, if we, you know, maybe if, going from a team who are perhaps not being run particularly in the mould that you'd imagine to, if we start our journey, I suppose, across Europe and go to Belgium first, because I've seen a lot of people in the comments talking about this, asking us to at least mention Royal Union Saint-Gilloise, or USG as they're known, over in Belgium, who at the halfway stage are top of the league in almost an inexplicable manner. It's actually nuts when you look at the numbers behind this. They were a second division side for the last 45 years. They were like a Belgian giant up into the sort of mid-1930s, but then kind of disappeared a little bit. They only have a capacity of just 9,400 people at their stadium. And they got achieved promotion, like I said, last year. And they're absolutely romping almost to the title as it stands. They've got sort of 4-point leads on Club Brugge in second place. And this is a side that haven't spent any money on a player in the last 2 years, which is kind of bonkers when you think about it. I mean, they're owned by Tony Bloom, who's the guy that runs Brighton. He's obviously pumped millions into Brighton, but he doesn't even use USG. They hardly take any players on loan from Brighton at all. He uses them as two completely separate entities. And I mean, just to give you an idea of how bad they were when they took over in 2018, they didn't even have a dressing room or showers at their training ground. So the players would have to drive to the main stadium, get changed there, go over to the training ground, which is away from the main stadium, train there, and then head back to shower. So he's completely sort of flipped the whole infrastructure at the side. It's pretty remarkable, really. I mean, if you look at some of the signings they brought in, Christian Burgess, he was a sort of a discarded centre-half from Portsmouth. He had over 170 points.
I know him.
As in personally, or just as a
No. He was very tough to play against when he was at Portsmouth. Against Sunderland, we had a titanic few clashes against Portsmouth, and Christian Burgess was a really tough guy to get past. I'm very surprised he's ended up at USG. I thought he was probably a bit good for League One. But fair play, he's taken an interesting career move.
It looks like he's going to end up playing, he's on course to play Champions League football as it stands so far. Apparently they were looking for height, and it's all data driven the way that USG works. And even if you look at Dennis Undav, he scored 16 goals and 9 assists this season. He was signed from the Belgian third tier for nothing. Dante Van Zier, he's a Belgian forward with 11 goals and 9 assists. He came for free from Genk. So they clearly know what they're doing. And just to give you a bit of a comparison, Brugge, they sold talents worth €27.2 million this summer and invested over €47 million in their squad. And like I said, USG haven't signed anything. I mean, Deeks, can you remember a side? Because it looks like they're not slowing down in their hunt for that title. Can you remember a side sort of take a division by storm like this? And I mean, in terms of like the data-driven approach, do you think this is something we're going to see more and more? Because clearly it's really paying off in this situation.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen smaller teams in the past come and upset the apple cart. I mean, Midtjylland weren't a big side 15 years ago or so, but haven't really seen a side like this. I think it's really impressive, and massive credit to Tony Bloom. He's a really intelligent, shrewd operator. I think the work he's done at Brighton, not just hiring Graham Potter, who is linked with every top job in the Premier League right now and probably will get start being linked with top European jobs before too long as well. Dan Ashworth, who he brought in as I think director of football or head of recruitment, who used to work for England at the FA. He's a very smart operator as well. So I'm not really surprised. Tony Bloom's got his head screwed on. But yeah, massive credit to the USG operation, because I'm struggling to think of a bigger upset in terms of that spending you would talk about, the signings they're sort of signing, the age profile of some of their players that they've brought in as well. It's really unique. So yeah, massive credit to them, and hopefully they can wrap up a well-deserved title.
Absolutely. All right, McCubs, the Netherlands, that's where we're heading next. What's going on there? Because, I mean, on the face of it, it's a classic title race between PSV Eindhoven and Ajax, but the fact that Ajax have only conceded 4 this season is mental, and yet they're still second.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. PSV have just been a winning machine. Ajax have a goal difference of plus 55, which is 32 more than PSV. PSV just seem to be incredibly good at winning games. I feel like with Ajax, we're very used to seeing them win by 6-7 goals in games. PSV less so. I think they're a less talented squad, but they do have some really good players in there. We talk about Ajax as one of the top, teams in Europe now. You'd probably put them in the top 10 teams in Europe, wouldn't you? They certainly have been one of the most impressive sides in the Champions League. And, Ten Hag has built another brilliant squad. I feel like we've spoken about a lot of their players, especially on Continental Club. We were speaking about Lissandro Martinez last week, weren't we? And how well he's developed since signing for them back in, 2019? To have them being challenged so well in the title race, I think is testament to actually how good the Eredivisie can be. I think that there is a big drop-off in that league in terms of quality, and I think that's why people don't kind of, you know, people don't even really consider it as good as the Portuguese Primeira Liga, just because they have probably a slightly better spread of talent across the top teams. But I think, yeah, the Eredivisie is certainly in a better place, I think, at least in terms of the top sides, than it was a few years ago. We've got, you know, a player like Cody Gakpo at PSV, who's just been unreal this season, hasn't he? He's their joint top scorer on 6 goals. I think he's got something like 10 assists as well.
Yeah.
I think he's had a really underrated season. He's only 22 years old. He's a local lad from Eindhoven, came through the youth ranks and whatnot. So he's been brilliant, but you know they've also got a really you know good setup in terms of the team as well. They've had 15 different scorers this season. 10 squad members are on 3 goals or more, so it has been a real team effort. And they haven't lost since the 24th of October, when surprise surprise it was Ajax who beat them, one of only 3 sides to beat them so far this season. So after 19 games, PSV lead them by 1 point. Ajax lost recently to AZ. They also lost at home to Utrecht earlier in the campaign. So yeah, on current form, PSV are the slightly better side, but I feel like Ajax will claw it back somehow. I just think the talent in their squad is ridiculous. Obviously, we've spoken a lot about Dusan Tadic this season, haven't we? Broke that assist record, sorry, for a calendar year last year. Seb Haller's been an amazing signing, hasn't he? Like, he's really you know, hit the form of his life. 12 goals and 4 assists so far this season. Antony is only getting better and better. You know, they've even been able to afford, you know, letting David Neres go this window to Shakhtar Donetsk. And also, we do need to shout out, because I was you know, looking at kind of the, as a United fan, looking at stuff about Dean Henderson recently, and he was linked to Ajax back in December, kind of for a loan deal. And you know, Dean Henderson, you know, as a young goalkeeper, seems to tick a lot of the boxes that you'd think would be suitable for an Ajax signing. And obviously Onana, you know, unfortunately had that drugs ban, which is, you know, now he's leaving the club as well. But since he's been out, Remco Pasveer has done a pretty amazing job. Yeah, like, nuts. He has a save percentage of 91%. He's conceded just 3 from 35 shots on target faced. so yeah, I mean, he's been pretty amazing, and in the Champions League as well, he stood really firm as well. So yeah, I think everything's just kind of clicked for Ajax this season. And yeah, I think I'd be surprised if they don't take the title. PSV, like, I don't think you can take anything away from them, but I just don't think they're as good a team. But yeah, it's a fascinating title race there. You know, I think, you know, we speak about kind of the competitiveness of somewhere like the Premier League, and you know, I think kind of year after year, I'm always yearning for a really good title race, and we very rarely get one. I think we've had 2 good title races in the Premier League over the last 10 years, which is pretty shocking, actually. It just goes to show, actually, how superior Man City have tended to be in most seasons. You look at the Eredivisie, where, you know, supposedly Ajax have a lot of the power, but actually it isn't the case. You know, this is one of a number of great title races we've seen in the division over the last few years, despite, you know, a side like Ajax becoming better and better and better, especially on the European stage. So yeah, this is definitely a league to keep your eye on over the next few months.
Completely agree. But for Ajax to have scored 59 and conceded 4 and still be second in the table is, after 19 games, that's just crazy. That's almost 3 goals a game, isn't it? I mean, it might even be over 3 goals a game. But I mean, just Dukes. I saw a lot of debate recently about Dean Henderson, that move to Ajax, if it did go ahead, if that would be a step down in his career. A lot of people saying, with respect to the Eredivisie, that would be a step down for his career. I mean, where do you stand on that? Because I think for an opportunity to go and play for a great club like Ajax, if they've got the money to sort of pay the wages he's after, I don't see why. I think it's disrespectful to the Eredivisie to suggest that would be a step down for him.
Yeah, I don't understand that. It's clearly a step up from United's bench. And with David De Gea in such magnificent form this season, he's probably the only United player that can say that he's consistently performed at his best this year. I think Bruno's shown it in patches. that's about it, really, in terms of their top performers, at least. So, yeah, De Gea's not going anywhere fast. Like, massive credit to him for turning around his career after a really difficult few years following the 2018 World Cup. And Dean Henderson, a move to Ajax is not to be sniffed at. Like, they're competing in the latter stages of the Champions League. They're a really well-supported club in a beautiful stadium, in a top city as well. Like, what's not to love from his perspective? And the other links that you keep on seeing with him are a move to Newcastle. I think they probably could do better than Dubravka, who's frequently injury prone as well. But if I was Dean Henderson, I would jump at the chance to join Ajax over Newcastle. Right now, at least, because you'll get the opportunity to play in a last 16 of a Champions League tie rather than be fighting relegation, which Newcastle in all likelihood will be for the next 6 months. And then you just don't know what's going to happen with their manager going forward, who they're going to bring in the summer. The whole situation could change dramatically. And, you know, I think just this is a great opportunity for Dean Henderson if it actually comes and lands at his feet.
Absolutely. I mean, I don't know why Newcastle keep looking at goalkeepers either. I mean, I swear that's the least of their worries. I saw them linked with Keylor Navas this week, which is just another one of those ridiculous...
they need to sign a centre-back or two. Like, Jamal Lascelles is having a horrible campaign and no one's really talking about it. He's been dreadful.
I feel like he's been dreadful for a while. But anyway, let's just go to Spain quickly. We obviously cover this in Continental Club a fair bit. I mean, back in for our sort of New Year's Christmas special, we predicted our top four this season. I mean, since then, Villarreal look like they're going on a bit of a run. And also, you know, Sevilla look like they aren't backing down either. I mean, Dukes, Julian Lopetegui, because this is as unique a top four a race we've seen in Spain for a long, long time. I don't think this is I certainly can't remember a race quite like this in sort of the pre-Barca Real Madrid dominant years. Do you think makes Lopetegui so good that he can get Sevilla over the line here? And do you think Villarreal really have a chance at top four?
I think he's always been really highly rated as a coach. I think even at Porto and then with the Spain team, like all the reports coming out where his training sessions are excellent. I think he's a reasonably good man manager as well. It seems like they're a very happy camp. Just small things like body language seems very good at Sevilla right now as well. And massive credit to him because, yeah, they set a points record for Sevilla last term. The year and also reached the Champions League, was it last 16 and lost to Dortmund, was it? So they did quite well in that as well. And then the year before that, I think they won the Europa League. Was that under Lopetegui as well? Unless I'm misremembering. Yeah. So, yeah, massive credit to the way he's turned around Sevilla and taken them to a new level because they've always been one of those sides that were consistently in and around the top four but not really making a dent on a title race or too many domestic cups at least. We're just sort of Europa League specialists and he seems to have managed to improve their European performances, and also get them in the title race. Massive, massive credit. And, you know, until the summer when Jules Koundé will almost definitely leave, it's a pretty settled squad there as well. And I think they've recruited really well over the last 12 to 18 months as well. So huge credit to Lopetegui. I do think he is one of the more underrated managers in Europe right now.
Yeah, completely agree. I mean, even if you look at their squad, it's just not... Even Jesus Navas still featuring, Marcus Acuña, he's one of their sort of top players this year. Lucas Ocampos, he was always sort of... I think he had his moment where he was suggested as a sort of a future star, but he's never quite hit that height. He's looks excellent this season. Eric Lamela looks a bit more comfortable playing over in Spain. I mean, McCubbin, if there is a year for Sevilla to do it, do you reckon it's now, or do you just think Real Madrid are just too strong in terms of that title challenge?
No, I think it's possible for Sevilla to do it. I think Real Madrid have been great and have been... I feel like Real Madrid have in some ways been a bit more fun than we've seen them in the last couple of seasons. Perhaps that's just because Benzema and Vinicius have been on fire, but it's been really nice to see that midfield perform so well. I think, you know, like Kroos and Modric have hit some of the best form in the last 12 months that I can remember, really. And I think it's just been quite nice to see, you know, that midfield, which I think inevitably will be broken up in the next 2 to 3 years, kind of have one last hurrah. so in that sense, I think Real Madrid have been, I don't know, I think they've kind of flat to deceive in that sense. I think they're very catchable. Like they weren't amazing for large parts of last season, you know, and I think the big difference this year compared to seasons past is that we haven't seen them, you know, okay, they lost to Getafe, but that was their only real big loss against a smaller side. I think they've just, I think they've just kind of got over the line against smaller sides a lot better than in seasons past, where we were seeing teams like Betis beat them at the Bernabeu that wasn't an unusual occurrence. Whereas now I think they are they're on a really good run of form, but I don't know, their defence isn't, you know, completely watertight. I wouldn't say that, say like Thibaut Courtois, I don't know if he's necessarily, you know, at the level that we saw him say 2 seasons ago. I think this Real Madrid team can still be got at, and I don't think they're going to have as good a second half of the season as they did in the first half. So I think Real Madrid will inevitably drop points at some point. They've only lost 2 times in the first 21 games of the season. Sevilla have only lost twice as well in the first 20. And yeah, scoring wise, they've been great, but Sevilla have a much better defensive record. I think as a defensive unit, I think they are probably better organised. So yeah, I think Real Madrid's still favourites, but like Sevilla are 5 points off them with a game in hand. And I think that's, you know, that's testament to just how consistent they've been so far this season. Like even say back in kind of September, October, and, you know, Sevilla were not particularly, you know, at the front of the chasing pack. When you looked at the underlying numbers, they were pretty much the best team in Spain in terms of expected goals, in terms of the chances they were creating, and most importantly, the how few chances they were giving away. And yeah, I think you do have to give, you know, huge credit to Lopetegui for the way that he's developed this side over the last few years, as well as Monchi for the kind of transfer policy and just how well they've been able to, you know, get performances out of players who looked kind of in their twilight years before. So yeah, I think they absolutely have a chance, for sure. Like, in a month's time, maybe Real Madrid will pull away and it'll become more difficult. But right now, I think Sevilla should really fancy their chances.
Absolutely. Let us know if you want us to do any more sort of deep dives on Sevilla or Lopetegui, because he's, like you said, he's really resurrected his career, really turned it around after that complete nightmare, which was leaving the Spanish national side. And also, shout out to the referee for calling off their game against Betis the other day, after that metal bar was thrown on the pitch and hit one of the players in the head. That was not the kind of scenes you want to see. But yeah, I genuinely think this is as exciting La Liga as we've seen in a long time, if you exclude the top three. It really has got all to play for. Villarreal looking strong. I can't believe I backed Valencia the other day. Maybe I'll take that back. I'll change my mind to Villarreal. But yeah, so much to look forward to over the next few months in La Liga. Let's just go to Turkey, not somewhere we normally go this year. But, I mean, it is remarkable just how sort of weird the table looks at the halfway stage. Well, Trabzonspor, they're top, sort of look like they're racing away with the title. I think they've come runner-up 4 times this century, but never managed to sort of get over the line. Recently, 2019-20, they came runners-up. But even Konyaspor, who've never finished higher than third in the Super League, they're second at the moment. And if you look at the traditional big three, Fenerbahce, Beşiktaş and Galatasaray, they start at sixth, and then Galatasaray down in 13th with Beşiktaş in eighth. So massive drop off there. And actually, Turkish football is in a giant pickle. I was reading about this, doing some research going into this. They're currently 18th in UEFA's coefficient, which means they've lost their automatic Champions League spot. To give you an idea, teams like Cyprus, Switzerland, Croatia, Scotland, Czech Republic, all these leagues are higher than them at the moment. So, and if you look at the net worth of some of these clubs, it is huge. I mean, when Galatasaray lined up against St Johnston in the qualifier for the Europa League this year, you're talking about St Johnston are 1/10 of the size of Galatasaray in terms of revenue, but still managed to give them problems. And Galatasaray in particular have taken a giant drop off. We look, the sort of 4 defeats in the last 7 games, only 1 victory. That squad is an absolute shadow of its former self. They've got DeAndre Yedlin and Patrick Van Aanholt at fullback. I actually thought Van Aanholt was a good pickup by them this summer. But I mean, they've used 30 different players this season, which is an absolute nightmare. Weirdly, when it won their Europa League group, winning 3 and drawing 3 in a group featuring Marseille, Lazio and Lokomotiv Moscow, which is no mean feat. But they've only managed to sort of win 7 times in 21 appearances in the league at the moment. And when you try and sort of get your head around what on earth is going on in Turkish football. It's all to do with money. If we look in 2000, the combined debt of the Turkish Super League clubs was around 60 million euros, with total revenues at about 150 million euros. That debt has swollen to 2.3 billion euros, which is huge. Fenerbahce's debt alone is around 620 million euro mark. And it's just a lot of awfully managed clubs. They all tend to be sort of run by members, but there's no accountability for what owners can do in terms of borrowing, etc. Apparently they're trying to change legislation now in order so these owners don't come in, just create headlines and leave. It's also heavily linked to the lira, so the government as well. There's a lot of sort of apparent corruption involved as well. So when the Turkish lira really fluctuates, the big clubs really struggle too. And it's getting to a point that it's out of hand for certainly the bigger sides in Turkish football. So I think this is going to be a trend we're going to see a while of the big boys really struggling to hold on. I mean, the Cubs, Galatasaray in particular, these are clubs with, they've had great teams over the years. They've been excellent, but they are just looking like a real shadow at the moment. And it's kind of quite, I think it's quite sad to see, because we saw Fenerbahce struggle in recent years and they haven't really kicked on either.
Yeah. I think Turkish football has been one of the kind of stranger leagues over the last few years, hasn't it? In terms of the old giants, you know, facing quite big challenges and huge mismanagement, especially in the case of Fenerbahce. How Philip Koku managed to go from there to Derby County, where he was basically an equally big mess, is one of the, you know, great. just don't know how that happened. But then when you look at, you know, a club like Istanbul Başakşehir here, who obviously kind of represent a lot of the new money in Turkish football, they obviously won the title a couple of years ago. They kind of represent Erdogan, don't they, to a certain extent. That's kind of his part of Istanbul.
Are you getting shivers remembering them, the Cubs?
Yeah.
Sorry?
Are you getting PTSD remembering Istanbul Başakşehir here?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, yeah, of course. I completely forgot about that, to be fair. But yeah, one of the great Man United defence displays in European football. I completely forgot about that. But yeah, thanks for reminding me. Demba Ba.
Anytime.
Demba Ba's second greatest goal after that Liverpool one. But I mean, they went from winning the league to like staving off relegation last year. I can't lie, I'm not an expert on Turkish football. I haven't done enough research into that league in particular. But it's a really difficult to predict league. And obviously you throw into that the huge fan culture over there, just how passionately the clubs are supported and whatnot. And it makes for, there should be a documentary on it, really. There may well be, and I've just not come across it. But it would be a fascinating watch.
No, I agree. It's weird that as their national team has sort of enjoyed something of a resurgence, the league seems to be taking a real hit. All right.
I was going to say about the national team, because although they have enjoyed a bit of a resurgence, they were woeful at the Euros. Yeah. Everyone's dark horses for the tournament. I think respective to their abilities and playing stuff, they were by far the worst team at the Euros. So this is just more misery for fans of Turkish football. So I hope they can get back some joy.
Yeah, I was reading a lot of the journalists were blaming it on the fact that domestically, Turkish players for the big sides just don't play enough. And if you look at the squads, they're all littered with sort of, I would say, mediocre international footballers purchasing so many aging superstars. Apparently, like the contract they gave Van Persie at Fenerbahce was laughable, the amount of money he was earning there during his time. And it's just a lot of the domestic players have suffered, which has opened the door to these smaller sides like Konyaspor to sort of rise up. Yeah, so keep an eye out on the Turkish league. Also in Poland, we've seen Legia Warsaw go in their worst run in 85 years. They've been champion the last two seasons straight, champions five out of the past six seasons, in fact, as well. But this year, fighting off relegation in the 17th, Artur Buruk's big injury has absolutely shattered them down there. And what's weird is they started the season by beating Leicester City in Europa League and then, went on their worst run in 85 years. So that's over in Poland. But, I mean, Deegs, if we just finish off in Italy, which is another league really kind of bouncing around a bit bizarre at the moment. We saw Spezia beats AC Milan in the San Siro yesterday, which is a game they will remember. I mean, what is it about the Italian league that's really caught your eye this season, do you think?
I think it's just been really, really fun to watch. I think, obviously, you know, putting aside Inter Milan, you know, being sort of sweeping all before them, at least not in terms of points so far, but I think they will eventually pull away. Like, they've got the best defence. Their attack has more than compensated for the loss of two of their best attacking players in the summer in Hakimi and Lukaku. It's got to be that there are just six or seven teams, actually maybe a little bit more than that, and maybe include Sassuolo in that as well, who can create a lot of entertainment. I don't think the standard of defending is particularly high in Serie A. It's complete opposite for what it was like 15 years ago, where Catenaccio was still in full play, and, you know, teams got very deep in the Champions League on the basis of very solid defences, and Italy's World Cup win was based off that as well. I think now the standard of defending, particularly at some of the top clubs, is really quite low. I mean, look at Roma with Mancini and Smalling as their centre-back duo. That's not exactly great, is it? I mean, outside of AC Milan and Inter, I don't think there are too many great defensive partnerships when they're fully fit, really. Ratmani starting regularly at Napoli. Like, they're just not that... The standard of defending is not that high at the moment in Serie A, but it's leading to some really entertaining games and some great storylines as well. It's always fun, Mourinho, watching Mourinho continue to blame his players' mentality when really he should probably have a bigger look at himself. And Atalanta have really picked up form in the last month or two as well, and are entering sort of a late challenge for the title race potentially. And Juve, since Allegri switched from 4-4-2 in mid-December, I think the last 10 games only Inter have picked up more points. So I wouldn't be surprised if Juve, you know, continue to improve as the season goes on, although that Chiesa injury might come back to bite them. So there's a lot to get your teeth stuck into in Serie A right now, and I think the standard of games maybe aren't as high as they were 15 years ago, but they are way, way more entertaining.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. I saw that a damning stat the other day which said that Allegri's points per game was worse than Pirlo, his goals scored per game was worse than Pirlo, and
yeah.
But I mean, it is a tricky one. I mean, McCubbin, if you had to pick one team outside Atalanta to watch, because we've seen sort of even Torino scoring goals recently, Hellas Verona, they look like they can score goals every game at the moment. Fiorentina putting six, scoring six past, what was it, Genoa yesterday, who've already fired Shevchenko. He's already gone after nine games. What an awful decision that was to leave Ukraine for Genoa. He's unemployed now. I mean, who do you enjoy watching the most in that Italian league?
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously hard to look past Atalanta, but I mean, Napoli were great towards the start of the season, weren't they? I think Inter are probably arguably the best team to watch. I mean, they're in terms of goal scoring, they've just gone supernova, haven't they? But like Empoli, they've not been in as good form recently, but at the start of the year, or at least kind of, you know, October, November time, I think they had some crazy record where they came back to win like four out of five games in a row or something. I think they've picked up like more points from losing positions than most clubs do in an entire season. So they've been really entertaining watching that sense, just like so much drama, lots of late goals and whatnot. You know, and they're not, you know, they're very much, you know, they're just, you know, newly promoted, kind of making a charge for kind of mid-table, aren't they? So when you consider that, I think it just kind of goes to show just how just how fun this league has been, like across you know, from the top to the bottom. And I think it's kind of been coming for a while, I feel, because I think when you look at the top five leagues in Europe over the last few years, I think Italy has always consistently had that very kind of even spread of quality from kind of even when Juventus were dominating from like second place to like eighth place, there seemed to be quite an even spread. You know, I know there was that great Sarri team at Napoli, but the fight for Champions League football was always really, really enticing, especially when Milan and Inter weren't at the level that they are now. And I feel like that's, you know, since Juve's dropped off, that's just kind of become, you know, that's just become even more inclusive in terms of the top 10 of Serie A. So yeah, I think there's always really interesting storylines. I think the managerial quality is always really consistent, isn't it? So I think that's always a reason to watch as well. Torino as well, they're a club to keep your eye on. their manager is kind of a disciple of Giampiero Gasperini, and they've been playing some really entertaining football. So yeah, there's so much to keep your eye on, and I think that's what makes Serie A so special this season.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. Also, it was I don't know if you saw Vlahovic miss a Panenka. He'd already ran off celebrating, and then Sidogu basically stood up and saved it. That's a bit of hubris. Although
stuck a Palmer.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's a bit of hubris for him, but I'm sure he'll get back. But yeah, so much. So a lot in Serie A is back in a big way. I think we've been saying that on Continental Club, and you know it is super as exciting as it's ever been. But I think that pretty much concludes our journey around sort of the more stranger divisions in Europe this season. Some of the stranger stories. If we've missed anything, if your domestic league, wherever you are, has something bizarre and intriguing going on, let us know in the comments down below, and we'll try and get back to you as quickly as we can. Dukes, thank you so much for being here on the Extra Time Pod, as always. What should our viewers go to if they haven't already?
Oh, why don't you go check out Euro Transfer Talk, which came out earlier on Euro Football Daily, about Christian Eriksen potentially making a sensational return to the Premier League with Brentford. What a storyline. Love Christian Eriksen. It would be great to have him back in the league if that is completed.
Yeah. Mikey, what do you think about Eriksen? Back for Brentford?
Oh, that'd be great. Yeah, I'd love it. I'd love it. Going to the most kind of, you know, lovable club in the Premier League. Yeah, joining the Danish Revolution there. I'd be really excited about that.
Love it. Well, thank you for joining us too. According to the Fulhamish podcast, Fulham want Eriksen as well. So if he's listening, definitely. Him and Mitrovic, that's the link up I want to see.
A West London race for Eriksen's signature. Love it.
Gosh, there we go. All right, guys. Thank you very much for listening at home, whether it be on whatever podcast device it might be. Make sure you're liked and subscribed to the Extra Time podcast channel. And we look forward to seeing you next week. Bye-bye.